What's up, everybody? This is Bro Plus Hipster Podcast, episode 6. I know there's been a long break between episodes, been a bit busy with adulthood and work and whatnot, but we have a very special guest today, former college roommate and very good friend, Blake Jones, out in Chicago. Say hi, Blake.
What's up, everyone? Nice to talk to you.
So as some background, Blake is currently a second-year resident in Chicago. And he reached out to me. I don't know if he saw a post on Facebook about the election. It was like, this election's out of control, man. We got to do a election-based podcast. And I love the idea. We unfortunately haven't spoken in a while. And I would love to hear what he had to say, as I imagined everybody who tunes in would as well. So go ahead, Blake. Start it off. What are you feeling?
No, yeah. I mean, No, I used to listen to your podcast, and it's been a while. I felt like this was probably an appropriate topic to fill some time, and one that I felt like I wanted to discuss with somebody. I did see your Facebook posts, and that kind of set this off. But I'd say just in like generally, I hate election season for numerous reasons, and I usually try to avoid everything, all media coverage and whatever. But and I had been doing a pretty good job of that this year, but then I think probably the RNC kind of really set me off. Obviously, Trump has been saying crazy things for a long time, but seeing the whole party kind of, well, not even the whole party, but a faction of the party come together and in Cleveland, and just the general rhetoric of that, and then obviously what's happened even since then, kind of setting off alarm bells in my head. And
it made it all too real, right? It was like,
yeah, it's like, how did we get here to nominating someone like Donald Trump to be possibly president of the, I guess, in my opinion, highest functioning liberal democracy in the world?
Right. I think that's fair. I think we are.
Yeah. But we are driving towards a ledge that I really do not want us to go over.
I think,
and it's just a mystery to me in large. But I have some theories, and I think that's why I wanted to talk to you, Luke, about them and kind of get your opinion and to see where we can go from there.
No, I would love to hear the theories. I'm sure they're very well thought out. But I think the question is, how did we get here? That's what you need to ask. And so much of the Republican National Convention is really kind of spectacle, as is everything that has been leading up to it. And I think the biggest moment was when Trump actually gave his speech. It was so scary to me. He was speaking, and there was like 100 American flags in front of him, and then just a huge screen of his face in the background. And it actually reminded me of V for Vendetta. I was like, this is a totalitarian leader propaganda, you know? It was really kind of a terrifying image, but so much of what has led up to his rise has been, you know, precisely that. Spectacle, imagery, harping on emotion rather than logic. I think this is something I discussed in the Facebook post too, but it just seems like in contemporary politics or contemporary media kind of as a whole, there's just this kind of undercurrent of irrationality that is really, really scary. And I'm trying to trace where it comes from. And obviously some of it comes from people not being adequately educated, but it's really kind of terrifying.
Yeah, I think education is an interesting, I guess, way to go. I think a lot of it is just that there is a giant segment of our country that is starting to feel left out or kind of subjugated in a way. Whether they're right or wrong, I'm not necessarily sure, but I think they've seen kind of their standing, and a lot of it is the kind of older end of the baby boomer generation, and as our economy has shifted away from, I guess, their idea of what the U.S. economy should be, they've kind of lost a sense of representation in our government, which I understand, and I think I think that's who Trump is speaking to and who's probably most receptive to his message. But I guess, so then where does education come in? And I think you can talk about education two ways. Obviously, a lack of education does not allow people to, I guess, critically analyze what Donald Trump is saying in a way that might make them more likely to reject it or might make those same alarm bells that are going off in our heads go off in theirs, because maybe they don't have the same exposure to world history. I'm not sure.
Or even I think you're right, world history, because a lot of this stuff has repeated itself. But at a more basic level, I think it's just critical thinking ability. It's the ability to look at a proposition that somebody says and then understand how it's supported with evidence or how it's not supported with evidence. Yeah, you know, or just basic cause and effect.
Care about facts.
But it's just basic cause and effect relationships. You know, people will make a claim and people accept it as true without understanding how cause and effect between events work. Like, it's very scary to, but yeah, you're right. People just don't care. But it's terrifying that the discourse has kind of gotten to that point.
Yeah. So I guess the more and more of the way I've been looking at this election is not it's not like a referendum on democracy or a referendum on fascism or totalitarianism or like the general direction of this country as much as it is a referendum on kind of human nature. And I think you look at this group that is supporting Trump, and I think there's definitely a diverse group of people who are in that group, but I think by and large a lot of them are the people who feel kind of left out. And I, you know, the question becomes is like the natural human inclination when you when things are not going that well for you as to basically blame all the others, because that's all Trump is really offering. Like, if you look at his platform and everything, most of the only thing people really know on a large scale is what he wants to do in terms of immigration and banning Muslims and all these things that are mostly just providing scapegoats for everyone to lash out at when things aren't going that well for them. Well, I don't think that it's their fault that things aren't going that well for them, but I think that there's kind of two options, and one is to latch onto a demagogue who is promising to be their savior, mostly in the ways of, as I said, providing scapegoats for them to lash out at, or is there a natural inclination to, I guess, continue the progression of globalization and try to understand how adaptation can lead to kind of a new type of economy or a new social order in this country that will be more conducive to participating in the world that is going to be in the next 50 years.
Right, but I think that the answer to that for an educated person is so clearly the latter, right? I mean, you never fight against evolution and win. As a doctor, as a scientist, you understand that to be the case. But even, I mean, you can look at it in technology too. Like, when people were fighting the advent of, you know, DVDs with VHS. I mean, history doesn't stop moving forward. Globalization isn't going to stop moving forward. And integration, although it seems like it's not moving forward quickly in America, is just the way of the future. And it just seems so fundamentally illogical and just fundamentally incorrect to deny that change, you know, deny that pendulum shift. But
no, I think that's kind of what I mean in terms of a referendum. Is that really the direction the human race is going to continue to go? I've kind of gone back to Hegel a little bit over the last few weeks, just because I felt like this is appropriate.
Nice.
And I, you know, obviously the historical context of Hegel is the reaction and reaction eventual progression of history. So I guess like the question is this the moment where we're seeing the Hegelian response to the Enlightenment? Has it been that long? Has there been one already, or is this it? And are we doomed to kind of go back into an enlightened time for a period? Or is Hegel just wrong, and this is kind of the plateau of human enlightenment, and now we're the reactionary forces that aren't just in this country. I mean, you see kind of anti-Semitic right-wing fascist movements popping up more prominently in Europe now as well. I mean, you have like ISIS in the Middle East. You have all these groups that are, you know, disconnected, but they all kind of represent, in my opinion, like a turn towards darkness in the human race. And I see this election as kind of a microcosm of where humanity might be going. And if Donald Trump wins, and if he can get the majority of the support in the United States of America, which proposes to be a great liberal democracy and is, you know, relatively young still, but hopefully still progressing, if he gets the majority of support in this country, I think that is kind of a sign that, you know, maybe we're wrong, and maybe the natural progression of human history is not towards, you know, liberal democracy being spread across the world, as Francis Fukuyama would say, but maybe it's just kind of the, you know, we're the special form of Sisyphus, constantly going to be pushing the boulder up and then eventually falling back down to the bottom of the hill.
Right. I think the Fukuyama interest point is great because, you know, he releases The End of History, which is pretty much saying liberal democracy and capitalism is ideologically the end of history after it defeats communism. Yeah. And then like, however many years later, maybe 10 years later, he needs to update the book with an afterword about Islamic fundamentalism, which is so great. Well, but
he was wrong.
Yeah, but I do think you're right. I do think you're right about Hegel, though. But I don't know if it's an ultimate statement that humanity is more prone to darkness. I think it is, as you said, which is like it's a counteracting force to the Enlightenment. So it will be a pocket. But once the darkness fights with the rationality, it will eventually, you know, history will continue to progress towards liberalism and freedom and rationality. You know, it's more like a temporary slaughter bench is, you know, however, this Donald Trump example. And then on the back end, after it's been suffered and after it has run its course, we would ideally come out stronger than we were before the Donald Trump experience, however many years down the road it was. But it is really scary to think about him in the Hegelian context. I hadn't really done that, but you're right. We are kind of prone to something like that, right? Like a second Dark Ages potentially. But what gives rise to that? You know, Islamic fundamentalism, obviously, because that's a physical threat, and when people feel unsafe, they'll subject themselves to those type of ideas because, you know, protection at all costs. But there's the economic issue too. Like it's scary to me that it can be economic considerations that are bringing out this much hatred as much as the threat of physical violence.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the unfortunate part about globalization is that you know, human beings are too slow to adapt to the changes that are occurring. So I think in some sense, you know, it is the fault of the leaders of this country and the leaders of our economic institutions that we haven't adapted to the changing order, even while we try to implement things like the TPP and we've had NAFTA in the 90s, which are all, I think, you know, attempts to adapt to the new world reality, but they don't really take into account the, you know, non-educated middle class worker and what's going to happen to them. Because, you know, I think regardless of what we do with GDP, regardless of who gets elected, manufacturing jobs are not going to be ever a prominent component of the American economy again. You know, we can increase tariffs all we want on imported goods, but companies are always going to have a cheaper option to go elsewhere.
And we shouldn't be doing that. We shouldn't be increasing tariffs, you know. But this is another point, though. I think a larger issue is defining the absolute good. You know, what is your objective as a politician? What policies are you trying to implement, and who are you trying to serve by implementing those policies? And I think the answer should be, as a country, we should be implementing policies that help the majority of Americans, whoever that may be. But then you look at you look at tariffs in the steel context, for example, you know, and that's a policy that protects the steel industry. People who are in Pittsburgh or in the United States working in steel mills, making steel. But that's not who we should be seeking to protect. Like, I understand a politician running in Pittsburgh, that's his constituency, so that's what you're going to do. But if you're really implementing policies to help America as a country move into the future, then the reality is we shouldn't be having tariffs on goods, and we shouldn't be protecting the domestic steel industry. We should let nature be running its course, or we should be trying to get ahead of nature to the extent that it's possible instead of trying to protect the past. But when you have unqualified objectives and you have factions and you're looking to represent factions instead of a mass of Americans, then you fall into this type of disconnect where nobody knows who's representing who, and walls get drawn, you know. And I don't say actual walls like Trump is proposing in Mexico. I'm talking more ideological walls between people who really are somewhat similarly situated, but they believe they're not.
Yeah. But I think that's right. I think you have to take us, like, your argument is somewhat utilitarian, but I think it's true. But I think you have to do that, but all at the same time understanding what's going to happen to the steel workers and, you know, their manufacturers when you don't specifically advocate for them, which is that they're going to lose jobs and they're going to lose, you know, their means of income, and they're going to fall in hard times, and they're going to look for a way out. And I think that's what we're seeing now. So I think the answer is yes, you're not going to be able to keep manufacturing jobs in the United States long term. I mean, there'll always be some here, but I think by and large, stuff is going to move outside the borders of this country. But you have to then have another way, and that's where I think education needs to come in, is we need to not necessarily, you know, train people to, it'd be nice if everyone could get a college education and, you know, read about Hegel and think critically, but I think more than that, you just need to have programs or some form of education or training for people to enter into the new reality of the American economy, which is a largely services-based economy. And that's what was not done, and that's why there's so much anger, I think, and so many people feeling left out.
Right. I think that's dead on, you know, whether it's service-based or even clean energy. You know, clean energy is something that we just totally missed out on. You know, a huge percentage of Germany's energy outputs now are based on renewables, and as the leader of the free world, there's really no excuse for why we're not close. But, and I, one of my friends from high school actually commented on the same post that you're referencing, and he kind of said that we should be blaming the liberal elite as much as we should be blaming anybody, because for the last, you know, 15 years, they haven't been doing enough to advance the middle class interests either. And I think clean energy is a good example. Not transitioning people to service-based jobs is a good example. A lot of this is just kind of governmental or political or even human inertia, you know, like just the inability to see the writing on the wall and to implement change quickly enough that people can be, you know, most properly benefit.
No, I think that's exactly right. But I saw that post. I don't know if you can't blame it all on like one group or.
Of course not. Of course not.
I mean, this is, I think, just the natural progression of history that we've kind of been talking about, and there's always going to be a group that, you know, as societies change, as economies change, you know, we're never going to be able to adapt quickly enough on like a community level, I don't think, to keep everyone going along with those changes. But I think we just have to be aware of that, and we have to, you know, start planning, at least now that we know all this, planning for the future. But my point mostly is that the answer is to not, you know, refuse to engage in trade agreements with the rest of the world, to build walls, to increase tariffs on imported goods. That is not the answer, because the reality is that the changes that are happening are not going to be reversed. And we need to understand our role in the world, and it's not going to be the, you know, manufacturing producers.
Right. I think that's part of the reason, in addition to Trump just being a lunatic, but that's another reason why I've just been depressed about the election, and it's because Obama's leaving. I think Obama understood that better than anybody, you know, and you see him opening Cuba, you see him betting the long game on Iran to open up, you know, it's just such a kind of hopeful or optimistic look at foreign policy. And it's, you know, Clinton's a little bit hawkish if she wins. Donald Trump, as I said, is a lunatic. So, you know, I think the best hope is that we don't take a step backwards. I don't know how hopeful we can be to advance that in the next 4 years, 8 years. I mean, hopefully Clinton can evolve a little bit and she's not as hawkish as she's been. But what's your thought on that?
I think it's hard to know exactly, you know, as I guess as she's been in the political sphere for so long, but I still don't fully know kind of where she comes across. I definitely think she's probably more hawkish than Obama, but I don't really know what that means. I mean, will she start a war in Syria? I doubt it. Is she going to, you know, reverse our on treaties to Iran and Cuba? I don't think so. I think a lot of her kind of more liberal positions are relatively new. Well, not new. I mean, she's been for universal health care for a long time.
Right.
But in terms of her kind of more, I guess Bernie Sanders-esque opinions,
right,
are new, and I'm not sure how really committed to those she is. I agree. I'm going to miss Obama too, but I think kind of Hillary's probably learned a lot from watching him. And I think, you know, she'll probably do a relatively decent job of continuing his policies. I think on some, you know, in some level, Obama maybe was a little bit too soft in terms of his treatment of Assad and,
you mean drawing a line in the sand and then not doing anything when somebody crosses it?
Yeah, I mean, I think they just found Assad's dropping more chemical weapons on his civilians this week. And I don't, I mean, I just think whoever is going to lead our country is going to be in an impossible position in that region of the country. Because if you really start a war with Syria, you're basically starting a war with Russia. And that's something we want to avoid at almost all costs. And I think Obama's biggest mistake was probably drawing that red line.
Right.
You know, he wasn't going to uphold it, but
that and calling ISIS a JV squad in about in the same month was probably his biggest
low
blunder.
Point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know,
but I agree, though. This is part of the reality in which we're working too, and it's globalization. It's technology, it's the rise of Islamic fundamentalism, whatever you want to call it. But the reality is that the world in which we live doesn't have easy solutions. Not to say there were ever easy solutions, but perhaps there were easier solutions. Whereas now it seems like we find ourselves very often in just straight up lose-lose situations, and we need to make a decision that allows us to lose least, you know? And that's not a great place to be in, but at the same time, I don't really know what else to expect. And maybe that's overly cynical or pessimistic based on what we've seen over the last, you know, 6 months to a year on the foreign policy front. But I don't know. I just don't. And I certainly don't see Donald Trump coming in and somehow, you know, negotiating our way from a lose-lose situation to a win-win situation.
No, definitely not.
You know?
For a really long time, I thought he was just kind of a figurehead who would, even if he won, probably he would have no interest in governing, which I still don't.
Does he? He doesn't, man. There's no way he does, right? It's insane.
No, I.
Also, what's going to happen? What's going to happen with his investments?
Ego trip.
Dude, what's going to happen with his investments? He hasn't even really discussed in detail the idea of what's he going to do with that. Like, he just says the words blind trust, which is much more difficult to implement. He hasn't addressed that at all. He still hasn't shown his tax returns. Like, it's just batshit insanity, the entire thing, man. And his tax returns are important. Like, we don't know where his money's been, who his allegiances are with. As a businessman, you know, he might have a lot of ties to Russia that currently aren't known. I mean, not to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but it's just, this goes back to the education too. Like, I don't think people realize the import of him bucking the trend of not showing your tax returns. That's something you know, it's not, sure, there's not a law, but there's a reason why that's been a practice that has gone on, you know, forever, and why Mitt Romney did it when Mitt Romney ran. And the fact that he's just refusing to do so, I don't understand how people don't realize what's happening. It's just baffling to me.
Yeah, it is baffling. I mean, it's because, like, you know, I think there's, like, you know, there's a segment of people, some of my friends included, who are like, and I don't really understand it still, but I was at a wedding over the weekend, and I was talking to one of my friends who's, he was like the top of my high school class. He went to Dartmouth, and now he's a pretty successful salesman. He did work for Bloomberg, but now he's moving on something else in D.C., and he is planning on voting for Trump. And I don't think he's thought it out too well. But his reasoning was that Washington is so corrupt, we need someone to just come in there and blow it up. And then I have other friends who think that he's like, even if he wins, he's not going to have any like political power because the executive branch just isn't strong enough. So he won't have that big of a detrimental impact no matter what. But I think, you know, those are both very dangerous arguments because there is a certain amount of executive power, and I think especially if Republicans remain in both houses of Congress and in and if Trump's allowed to nominate judges to the Supreme Court, you're going to have basically a psychopath with this huge egomaniac with the entire Congress and court at his back.
Right. Not to mention, I mean, executive power, executives have long had the ability to handle foreign policy outside of declaring war. They can enter tons of agreements. He can do a lot on the global front. And domestically, he's in charge of all the administrative appointments. And, you know, we currently have this fourth branch of government, which is administrative agencies, and he has the ability to appoint the leaders of all of those, to dictate policy through all of those agencies. So, I mean, I don't know. It's just the idea of Donald Trump leading our country is terrifying, is like totally terrifying to me.
Yeah, it is terrifying. I think, but, you know, so much of it is just the idea of someone like him. And, you know, more and more, like today, I saw about how he's now starting to prepare his supporters to think that if he loses, the election was rigged.
Was right. I saw that as well.
One of his biggest advisors came out talking about how he needs to start talking about like how like if he loses, there needs to be like civil disobedience in the streets, and we need to not recognize Hillary Clinton as a legitimate leader of this country because she would have won on a rigged election. And all this stuff, and I mean, this is like textbook totalitarianism
right
at play. And it's, you know, it's not just Donald Trump being Donald Trump. It's the idea of, you know, at worst he is a horrible demagogue, and at best he's a horrible demagogue. At worst he is a totalitarian dictator about to get his hands on, as I said, the greatest liberal democracy in the world.
Right. Not to mention the just hypocrisy between coming out and saying that there's definitely going to be some type of fraud if he doesn't win versus in the same week, you know, federal courts striking down voter ID laws in two large, you know, largely African-American populations, both in Wisconsin and the Fourth Circuit, upheld a North Carolina voter ID law that, like, was very clearly discriminatory intent to prevent African-American people from getting out and voting. So it's just, it's so funny that on one hand, you're already preemptively saying that the election was a sham, while your party has, for years now, actively been trying to pass laws to prevent the process from working in a way that isn't a sham, which is to say, to prevent people from actually exercising their right to vote. It's just the whole thing is deeply demoralizing.
I think the point is that the Republican Party, or at least factions of the Republican Party, are scary enough on their own, and they don't need Donald Trump.
Right.
To add to that.
Right. Yeah,
I mean, it's not Donald Trump trying to disenfranchise black voters in the South. It's not, he didn't repeal the Voting Rights Act. all this has been going on, and now you're basically throwing gasoline on the fire.
Right. Let me, not to get too far off track, but you're talking about kind of your friend who wants to vote for Trump just to blow up Washington. Obviously the leaked emails about the DNC were not great for Hillary Clinton, because it kind of perpetuates the image that Trump is trying to paint of her. But I've never really spoken to you about Bernie Sanders. I was wondering what your thought was on it. Were you ever a fan, or did you ever just acknowledge what he was saying, but from day one you never really viewed him as a viable candidate to be president? Because also, my friend said in that post, and I haven't been following the election that closely until recently as well, but apparently national polls had Sanders beating Trump head-to-head, but Hillary losing to Trump over the last few months leading up to the conventions, which I thought was an interesting fact.
Yeah, I think that's so.
I mean, I don't know how true that is, to be fair. I mean, I doubt that would happen, but no, the numbers are interesting.
Think both Hillary and Sanders could have beaten Trump.
Right.
I don't think Sanders was more likely to beat Trump than Hillary. But right. I think I was, you know, I never was someone who was going to vote for Sanders over Hillary Clinton. I liked Sanders, but none of his positions were really that tenable. I mean, he was talking about a lot of great things that would be good for young people and people with a lot of debt, or people who are anticipating having a lot of debt. But, you know, if you look at what Obama preached going into office and then what he tried to do and what he was able to get done, thinking about what Bernie Sanders preached and what he would have tried to do and would have been able to get done, he would have been able to get done absolutely none of it. And I don't even know that our country would be that much better if he had been able to do it. You know, I don't agree with his opposition to the TPP, and I don't think that, you know, drastically increasing the national debt, even though I think that can be good in certain situations and is probably still necessary at this time, I don't think his plan is going to be conducive to growing our economy in the long run. But then to the point of him leading in the polls, I think there were a lot of polls that showed that he would have fared better against Trump than Hillary. But then the other thing you have to understand, and I think, you know, what has been pointed out, I'm sure that your friend had heard this argument already, but Bernie Sanders was not subject to the...
Right, the attacks that Hillary Clinton
has been sending. Yeah, the attacks that Hillary Clinton had been under for a really long time. Yeah. And if you think about, you know, Hillary's background and how easy she is to attack, just think about Bernie Sanders, who openly has declared himself, you know, a fan of liberal socialism.
Right.
How easy that would be to attack for Republicans.
Not to mention potentially being an atheist.
Exactly,
which we all know is the silent minority, and they're really discriminated against minority in the United States.
So I don't think that argument is a very good one for why we should have chosen Bernie over Hillary.
Right. Do you think? Let me ask you this. This is strays from politics a little bit, and I'm not one to typically jump on these type of things, but the Hillary Clinton hatred. What, if any, degree of that do you think is attributed to misogyny? Because she's so clear. You think a lot of it? It's funny. Yeah. I think definitely it exists. I've had difficulty quantifying it recently in my mind, but it's just so clear to me that she's very much experienced and very much competent to do this job, you know, based on her legislative experience, based on her experience as Secretary of State. It's this hatred, like, I understand that people think she's tied to Bill, or she might have some type of unclean hands from being a politician for the last 30 years. But that aside, like, she's so incredibly qualified to be president of the United States. The more I hear these attacks, the more persuaded I'm becoming with respect to the belief that it's largely based on misogyny.
Yeah, I think it's impossible to quantify, but I think it's a huge component of it. I mean, she definitely has some skeletons in her closet. I think the email situation was a cluster for her and was definitely a huge mistake and makes her look bad. Not the DNC thing, I mean, as Secretary of State.
But Donald Trump raped his wife. He's defended tons of federal lawsuits, some of which for defrauding people to go to college. Like, it's,
if you're comparing her to Donald Trump, then there's no point even having the conversation.
Right, right, right. No, I'm just on the point of misogyny. On the point of misogyny, though, the fact that nothing sticks to Donald Trump, like, I can't chalk that up to anything other than just sexism.
Well, and who his supporters are. I mean, I think to some extent, his supporters are people who only hear what they want to hear. But yeah, no, I still think that misogyny and sexism plays a huge role. Because, I mean, if you think back, Hillary Clinton has been actually very popular in the past. And it's usually when she's not running for office or not trying to, you know, improve her political power in any way. And I think it's not a coincidence that the moment she runs for office or she, you know, tries to take a new position, that her approval ratings go way down and then they climb back up over time.
Right.
And I think that is just emblematic of kind of the inherent misogyny within our culture. And I don't think she's the most, like, you know, likable person. She's not, she doesn't have the kind of charisma of Obama or her husband, but I don't see anything in her to warrant the kind of, like, hatred and mistrust that she's accumulated.
No, I think so much of it too, and going back, it's good that you kind of tied it back into the Trump supporters, because so much of this is just like the fear of, you know, some base need to protect like early American ideals of masculinity is just pervading like so much of the discourse. Like, and it's obvious to say that when you have debates in which the now nominee of the Republican Party is talking about his dick size, like, it's just, well, like, it's just, I don't know, man. It's, like, what?
So, yeah, I mean, it's, like, too real for television at this point.
Yeah, it really is. It's like fiction, man. It's, like, the whole thing's, like, a David Foster Wallace novel, man. The more I think about it, the more I'm, like, oh, my God. This is, like, Infinite Jest on steroids.
Yeah, I mean, Trump kicked a baby out of his...
I saw that. He made fun of a physically handicapped person, man. And, like, no one, like...
It just gets more absurd literally every day. And, like... For a long time, it was just absurd, and I thought it was kind of, you know, I wasn't that worried. But, you know, now it has become somewhat frightening.
Right. I am hopeful, though. I do think that he will lose. I think voter turnout's going to be huge. Like, and if Donald Trump as a potential president of the United States isn't enough to mobilize people to vote, then maybe we should just fuck democracy, dude, honestly.
Yeah, well, I think that's what's going to happen if he wins.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, I think there's a very low chance of him winning still. But the fact that he's gotten this close, and the fact that, you know, regardless, he's going to get upwards of 40% of the vote.
Right. It's true.
It's not a good sign. Although, I guess, you know, the best possible outcome is that he loses and the Republican Party is forced to reconcile with that, and maybe we'll actually change, or maybe a third party will pop up, or something else good out of this could come. But that would be I don't know what the greater likelihood of that happening versus Trump winning.
Right. I think it's always a little risky to bet on the Phoenix rising from the ashes, right?
Yeah,
but
that's what was supposed to happen after Romney lost.
Yeah, it's true.
It got worse.
By the way, to go back to Obama for a second, have you seen that he's now published in a medical journal assessing?
Yeah, he was in JAMA.
Yeah, I read the article a couple weeks ago. It's, I mean, I guarantee, like, I'm sure that he wrote none of it, you know? Like, he just wrote an outline and then his staff, yeah, like, researched it and filled it in. But it was a light, interesting read, considering that it was in a medical journal. I understood it, and I can't imagine I understand most medical journal publication.
Yeah, it wasn't like a research article. It was just kind of a... I actually didn't read it yet. I haven't read it.
You should check it out. It's short, but it's good.
Well, it's about the Ford Affordable Care Act?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is, yeah.
But yeah, I should read it. I don't know. I think Obama has been a very good president. And I hope that he'll go down in history as one of our best presidents.
I think he will, man. I think history is going to look incredibly favorably on his 8 years.
as long as Trump doesn't win.
Yeah, that's in laws. As long as it's not erased in a year and a half.
Yeah, exactly.
That is correct.
No, I mean, I think the Affordable Care Act is far from perfect, and just a few other things, but by and large, you know, that's kind of like the other thing is people are so terrified of the status quo in this country, and I understand there's a lot of people that for which the status quo has not been good, but if you look at the last 8 years, we've had, you know, set the economy aside, we've had like very slow but steady progression of, you know, liberalism in general. The passage of, or the
repeal of DOMA,
gay marriage, right. And yeah, Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Or not the repeal, but the striking down of DOMA.
Yeah. A lot of, I feel like, social progress that's been going on in this country would instantly be erased. And that might just be more due to Mike Pence being the running mate than even Donald Trump himself.
Right. I've seen all these articles about Mike Pence, like, denying that cigarettes kill people and whatnot. Like, it just... I didn't, to be honest, I had no idea who Mike Pence was until he was nominated. And my former office mate last summer is from his state, and he was just like, this guy is horrible.
You know, it's hilarious is one of my good friends from high school is dating his niece.
Really?
Yeah, so they've been dating for a while now. But they, the whole Pence family is... super, super conservative, apparently, except for her.
Right.
But they, they were catapulted onto the national stage pretty quickly. But yes, if you don't know anything about his background, then you should read about it, because he passed, like, some of the most restrictive, defensive religion legislation in Indiana that basically allows businesses to discriminate against LGBT. He's specifically said he wants to, I guess, not repeal, but renege Roe v. Wade.
Right.
He's a much bigger threat to, I think, social liberals than Donald Trump would be.
Right.
But it's even more reason to run away from that ticket at full speed.
Yup. That is another podcast for another day, the role of the role of religion on American discourse and policy, and its unfortunately discriminatory effect. But
yeah,
but nice, man.
The only thing I guess was, I guess, kind of off topic as well, but watching the DNC last week, it was kind of a funny picture, because it was, I felt like, you know, a lot of people talking about how it was the most liberal platform in a long time, but the ambiance, or the, you know, the feelings of the DNC were so much more Republican, or at least conservative, than I remembered in the past, just in terms of like the exorbitant patriotism and, you know, USA, USA chants. It's like,
right,
Democrats are moving to occupy that space and the political sphere that Republicans have abandoned with Donald Trump.
Right. Yep. No, it's very much true, you know. It's funny, going back to the Hegel thing too, and we can wrap it up shortly after this if you have anything else to add, but it's always funny to remember how the parties have, you know, like, swapped sides throughout the course of American history, and that's obviously not happening here, but I don't know if it's comforting or discomforting that it is very Hegelian, you know, like, you look at the Know Nothing Party, you look at George Wallace, you look at these kind of rises and falls, and I guess it's comforting in the sense that those clashes need to happen in order for the synthesis, you know, the thesis and the antithesis to smash together, and then you have the synthesis, and the synthesis is always on an upward trajectory. So even though on a microcosmic level, when we're looking at these moments, history is always kind of trending upwards, and that's comforting. But at the same time, when you're living the reality, and theory is really only theory, and it's not as great as it is when you're kind of reading it in a classroom, when you're seeing it unfold before your eyes, I guess.
Yeah, well, I guess it depends on what's
epoch or time you come across
right
when you're alive. If you're there for the synthesis, it's probably a lot better than
right
if you're there for the antithesis. But hopefully we're there for the synthesis
right
the next, you know, right 15, 20 years.
Although I was saying, like, it was such a, like, terrifying time to grow up with, like, George Bush during your teenage years, and I was so happy to have, like, Obama marshal in, like, my formative first real adult years. But now if we were to, like, take the step backwards, it's just, like, just a horrible sandwich where the bread, like, has made up most of my human existence. And it was just, I don't know, man. It's just, like, on like an existential level, it's just, it's almost as terrifying as it is on a like practical level, but I don't know.
It's true. But hopefully you'll live out your life expectancy.
Yeah. Another, that's right. You know,
70 years to.
Oh yeah. I haven't told you, man. I plan on cryogenically freezing myself actually. So I'm going to try to extend that life period.
Who are you going to rely on you to unfreeze you at the right time? That's the real question.
Yeah, that's true. I meant to tell you, I was working on this deal today and, the antitrust attorney on the other side, his father, I guess, wrote the book that is considered like the founding of cryogenics. So this guy on the other side who we're on a call with is like heavily involved in like the Cryogenics Institute and whatnot. I was gonna, once we hopped off, I was gonna like do some more research into it, but I thought you'd appreciate that. It was pretty fascinating.
Yeah, that is crazy.
Yeah.
I think one life on this earth is enough for me.
Right. At this rate, yeah, you're probably right. But all right, man. Well, you got any closing remarks before we sign off? We're almost at an hour here. We're at 50 minutes. So nice work.
Yeah, it was good. No, I think we've touched on pretty much everything. Thanks for allowing me to vent all my thoughts and fears.
No, of course, so man.
I am still an optimist, and I still believe that history will progress.
I do too.
Donald Trump.
Hopefully.
That's the final thing I would say is that, you know, this sucks, but all will be good in the end.
You're a Hegelian after all, man.
Yeah, I am.
No, I am too. Steve used to always give me shit about it, but I'm a huge fan. I think it's the best way to look long term at history, but yeah, no, I agree. I think we'll come out of it okay. Hopefully we can look back at it and laugh, you know. That's what everybody always wants, right?
Yeah.
So, all right, man. Well, thanks for coming. I appreciate you reaching out and texting me. You got to hop on again. We can maybe take on some lighter fare.
Yeah, hopefully. You know, after November 8th, we can talk about something else.
We can talk about how LeBron's on his way to overtaking Michael Jordan as the greatest ever.
Yeah, we can talk about that.
I'm just kidding. I know as a Chicago fan, you would defend the mantle vigorously.
Well, I would, yes.
But, all right, man. Tell Diane I said hi, and it was good talking to you. Let's talk soon.
Sounds good.
All right, later, man.
Later, man.